The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. Coming up Friday, October 18th, in the Prax Lynn Hallstrom Detrick Concert Hall, the newly built center on campus, is the first in a lecture series. Begins at 5:30 p.m. It's called The Rural Voter, Separating Myth from Reality. It's hosted by Nicholas Jacobs and Daniel Shea. Sustainability is best achieved when we appreciate and learn from our differences, and when all people have capacity to meet their basic needs fairly and efficiently. A new OSU event lineup, Democracy in Action, a lecture series on American pluralism, will feature diverse viewpoints and attempt to bridge divides. It will explore how place, geography, economics, demographics, faith, religion, race, and culture are shaping the nature and quality of civic affairs and collective action in the United States. The first lecture in this series is coming up Friday, October 18th at 5:30 p.m. in the Prax Lynn Hallstrom Detrick Concert Hall, featuring Nicholas Jacobs, Assistant Professor of Government, and Daniel Shea, Professor of Government, both from Colby College in Waterville, Maine. Their lecture, The Rural Voter, Separating Myth from Reality, and the book, are based on over 100 years of data and results from three large voter surveys. The lecture is free and open to the public. There is more information online at leadership.oregonstate.edu. This is KORC, community radio that serves Corvallis. Thanks for joining us today on KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program that is on every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. It repeats 5 to 6 p.m. on Mondays, and you can find an archive of past programs at our website, korcfm.com.
Hello, listeners. Happy October. This is Wendy Byrne, bringing you a main course of information about our local government, with a serving of opinion on the side. I have details about recent meetings of the City Council and relevant information from other meetings that happened last week, and will take a look forward at upcoming meetings for October. You might remember that our City Council holds formal meetings on the first and third Mondays of each month, and meetings called work sessions on the first and third Thursdays of each month. So this past week, the City Council had their formal Monday evening meeting, as well as their Thursday afternoon work session. At the Monday night meeting, held on the second floor of the downtown fire station, the Council voted on three separate land use cases. The results left me and many others with mixed feelings. Let me break it down for you. Number 1, an annexation and zone change for a 1/2-acre piece of land in South Corvallis on Crystal Lake Drive. Number 2, an adoption of findings and an ordinance regarding the development of townhomes on property adjacent to Porter Park in North Central Corvallis. And number 3, a final vote on the adoption of findings and conditions to allow the Marriott Hotel to build a parking lot in our downtown. The first two passed easily and unanimously. In fact, there were no voices raised in opposition to either of them, and the Porter Park Neighborhood Association wrote a letter of support for the project proposed in their area. These two projects and votes reflect the type of development our city needs, and the type of development our plans, goals, and visions support. About that third issue, the Marriott Hotel parking lot, Councillor Charlyn Ellis said it very well at 53 minutes, 47 seconds into the meeting. Quote, "I am voting no on this because it goes against all of our guiding documents and state mandates, the comprehensive plan, the land development code, the transportation system plan, the climate action plan, our Vision 2040, which all ask for a walkable, pedestrian-oriented downtown," unquote. In counterpoint, Councillor Napack spoke in support of the plan, saying it supports the ongoing success of the Marriott Hotel. Councillor Napack seems to be of the mind that anything the Marriott wants, the Marriott gets, even if this means that our downtown becomes a giant parking lot. Never mind that recent studies of the parking situation in our downtown show that we have a poorly managed parking situation. And never mind that the Planning Commission recommended denial of the application. But I digress. The vote was split 5-4 in favor to approve the development with conditions as outlined in the staff report. These conditions demand the Marriott construct a 20-foot deep park that runs along the 2nd Street frontage of the parking lot. Voting in favor were Councilors Lytle, Yee, Napak, Kadena, and Chaplin. Voting against were Councilors Lewis, Shepard, Ellis, and Schaefer. So this case concludes with the Marriott securing permission to tear down two buildings in our downtown so that they can build a 10-space parking lot that is fronted by an awkward bit of open space and a few park benches. I'm not exactly sure how the addition of 10 parking spaces is going to allow the Marriott to be more successful, and I'm not sure how the loss of two buildings, which could potentially house several small businesses, will be good for the city's tax rolls. What is to stop the Marriott from buying the next two buildings on that block and tearing them down? What is to stop them from turning all of that end of downtown into their own private parking lot? Is this what we want for our downtown? But wait, there were other items on the agenda for the City Council this week. At that very same Monday meeting, they also voted unanimously to move forward with the Parks Maintenance Facility Project and directed the staff to proceed with a funding strategy for said development. While there is no immediate budget impact resulting from this vote, it does mean that the council has granted staff the authority to sell full faith and credit bonds for the project, which also means the voting public will not have a direct say in the matter. Are you concerned? Talk to your city councilor. It seems that there was a significant positive balance in our coffers at the end of the last budget cycle, and the city had $11.4 million remaining in the general fund to put into this project, which is approximately 1/3 of the expected cost of the new facility. So we only need to borrow $22 million or so to cover the rest. How interesting. And here I was, believing the past admonishments that we were walking some sort of tightrope over a pit of poverty. If we had $11 million in the bank, why don't we have flush toilets in Central Park? Why do our neighborhood streets look so awful? And why can't we pay city landscapers to prune the blackberries out of the planters around downtown? In other city council-related news this week, the council met several times in executive session to discuss the job performance reviews of their two employees, our municipal court judge and our city manager. They also devoted the entirety of their Thursday work session to the ongoing update of their strategic plan, with hopes of finalizing it sometime in November. The idea is that the strategic plan will help guide decisions made by this and future City Council members, and I find it interesting that they are so intent on getting this finished so close to the end of terms for 4 of the 9 of them. Because if you are in Wards 3, 4, 6, or 8, you might know that your City Councilor has decided not to run for another term. And if you are in Wards 1, 2, 7, and 9, your City Councilor has a challenger for the upcoming election. The City Council will not meet next week, and their next Monday evening meeting is scheduled for October 21st. For those interested, City Council meetings are streamed live on Facebook. The Corvallis Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force met on October 1st and does not plan to meet again until they give their final report to the City Council at the October 21st meeting. The Planning Commission met on October 2nd and meets again on October 16th, where they plan ongoing discussions about the Comprehensive Plan and Land Development Code text amendments. Since we have 17 people running for the various seats on City Council, perhaps next Sunday would be a good time to review some information about them. Additionally, the Downtown Parking Task Force has been meeting to discuss how to improve the management of parking, and the Climate Action Advisory Board will be meeting soon, all of which might produce some interesting information. Until then, this has been Wendy Byrne for KORC News, Music, and Civics.
KORC recently had a chance to visit Ants on a Log Cafe, located at 401 Southwest Jefferson Avenue, downtown Corvallis. I was curious about their dedication to sourcing food from local farms and producers. Let's hear what they had to say. KORC is sitting down with Sally Starker, who is the co-owner of Ants on a Log Cafe with her sister Wendy, and we're going to talk about running a local cafe that sources food from local food networks and farms all over our region. And Sally, I was just wondering if you could tell me briefly about the history of why you guys started Ants on a Log and how the business is working for you.
Yeah, well, we started the cafe about just over three years ago, in conjunction with the Valley of Rock Gym, which opened just before us. We started it as a goal of inspiring and educating and nourishing our community. We wanted a place that was welcoming and inviting for all people and all different dietary needs, and just a great space in the community for connection.
It's a quite unique experience being in the cafe. Maybe you've heard people say before, it's like kind of like spectating at a zoo. And with these big glass windows and people climbing on the rock wall at the other side, it's quite a fun eating experience. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about local food networks and how those fit work into your business model for the restaurant here.
Yeah, one of our goals is to source sustainably, organically, and as locally as possible. And so I have a wagon here at the cafe that I wheel down to the market twice a week. I work closely and have developed amazing relationships with our local farmers. And we have about 10 of them currently that I work with closely and get most of our produce. And it's so great to minimize waste with that as well. They give us tubs that we're not throwing away packaging of things shipped from miles and miles away, and we're getting the freshest, best for you produce that you can get.
Right. Large supply chains are something behind the scenes that a lot of people at a dining table might not think about. So you're able to source food from our region right here and have a smaller impact on the environment globally, and also connect local workers and local patrons with the actual work that goes in from seed to table.
Correct. Yep. And we've even taken our staff out on several farm tours, as well as they've gone out picking for us. We've been picked many different berries, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, and then we're also just going and learning about what these farmers are doing and all the hard work and the care and the love that they're putting in, so that we can come back and do the same here and serve just beautiful, amazing food to our customers. I guess the other thing that we really focus on is minimizing waste, and so we have a compost system that we use. We use reusable glass and reusable containers as much as possible. Even our to-gos are the option of either compostable or glass that our customers can bring back to us. And we have a sustainability stamp program. We also helped found the Benton To-Go reusable containers that about 9 other businesses in Corvallis are using as a container program to bring back and minimize the throwaway one-time use containers.
Well, thanks for mentioning that, because KORC is definitely interested in Corvallis's sustainability initiatives and how businesses work into that and how that fits into the larger county and state's initiatives to have a more sustainable economy and society. Did you want to shout out some of the local farms that you guys work with specifically?
Sure.
To source food?
Yeah, some of the ones that really have made a huge difference for our business: Little Garden Organic Farm, where we get a lot of greens and strawberries. Riverland Farm has amazing grapes and ginger, and Goodfoot Farm with their greens. La Mancha Ranch and Orchard with apples and hazelnuts. Rainshine Farm with beautiful melons and berries and greens. And Feather Root Farm that gets us our chicken and our egg. Our eggs.
And by the way, her sister Wendy just popped in to see if anybody was wanting to, or because someone was trying to buy some eggs, and they're both as busy as any of the employees out on the floor here taking the time to talk with KORC.
Yeah, thanks. Cameron Ridge Farm supplies us with our chicken and our microgreens, along with Woods Farm. Borage Farm with our blackberries, Kings Valley Gardens with our blueberries, Nourished with Nature with bacon when we've had our BLTs, And all these farmers have been so cooperative, so kind, willing to bend over to bring us food at times, or, you know, just those connections and the people make it all worth it.
Sounds like there's a big social element to,
so rewarding.
To
yeah.
running this that is just essential for a cafe trying to do what you're trying to do. And it also sounds like you kind of are able to adapt and build your menu seasonally, probably, from what's available.
Yeah.
Just in the area, because you're not getting this, you know, the same product all year round unless you're sourcing it from quite far away at certain times of the year. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah, we're working on our apple recipes and pumpkin recipes going into fall, and soups as the weather gets cooler. But we're just, yeah, so lucky to live where we do and have such a variety of beautiful produce all year round, really.
Well, we really appreciate you sitting down with KORC to share what's going on with Ants on a Log Cafe.
Thanks so much.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. The following is an article published at OregonLive.com on October 9th. The title is $16 Million Wrongful Death Suit Claims Instacart Delivery Driver Was Distracted by Company's Wayfinding App. A $16.4 million lawsuit filed by the estate of a Portland man on a Vespa scooter who was killed by an Instacart driver alleges the food delivery company is partially at fault for his death by providing its driver with wayfinding technology that distracted her as she turned into the scooter. A lawyer for the estate of Peter Pellegrin claims there is a systemic problem with gig economy tech companies such as Instacart encouraging their drivers to use wayfinding apps or interact with other technology, resulting in leagues of drivers who are distracted and rushing from job to maximize their pay. Major companies such as DoorDash, Grubhub, Lyft, and Uber have all been sued in recent years after pedestrians or other drivers have been struck. Pellegrin, age 74, was riding toward his home on his Vespa during daylight hours on February 7th, when 27-year-old Instacart driver Melina Torres turned her Jeep Grand Cherokee into him. The crash happened along Southwest Boone's Ferry Road near 19th Avenue, near where Portland borders Lake Oswego. Pellegrin, who was wearing a helmet, suffered many broken bones throughout his body, and he was rushed into surgery at OHSU, according to the suit. The suit says he died 25 days later, but leading up to that, he often appeared demonstratively in agony. And during periods of high lucidity, he displayed mental anguish over his condition. The suit faults Torres, as well as Instacart. Neither responded to requests for comment on the story at OregonLive.com. But Ralph Spooner, the attorney who is representing Pellegrin's estate, said big tech businesses like Instacart are aware of the widespread problem of its distracted drivers, yet they often try to claim a driver who crashes into someone else is an independent contractor and therefore the company isn't responsible. Spooner said, "These tech companies make huge profits while the drivers barely make a living wage." He continued to say, "They certainly should be held accountable when the drivers cause an accident while making a delivery, seriously injuring or killing someone." Last year, Spooner's firm signed a confidential settlement in a lawsuit against DoorDash and one of its drivers who was accused of looking at a company app when he blew through a stop sign and seriously injured another driver in Clackamas County. According to police reports in this year's Instacart crash, back in February, Torres told Portland police, who responded to the scene, that her phone was mounted to a holder, she was unfamiliar with the area she was delivering groceries to, and she didn't see Pellegrin before she turned into him. Police determined there wasn't evidence that she was distracted, but wrote her a citation for making a dangerous left turn, and she was later convicted and fined $140. Witnesses said Pellegrin was either traveling slowly or at about the speed limit, which was 35 miles per hour. Pellegrin's wife, Nancy Klinger, is representing his estate. They were married for nearly 40 years. He was retired at the time of his death, but spent his career as a national park ranger in California and Alaska, a traditional wooden boat builder, a teacher, and an environmental scientist who worked on innovative groundwater cleanup techniques in Oregon. The suit was filed last week in Multnomah County Circuit Court. That article was by Amy Green and entitled, $16 million Wrongful Death Suit Claims Instacart Delivery Driver Was Distracted by Company's Wayfinding App. That was published at OregonLive.com on October 9th. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll.
What I know about courage, I learned from my adoptive mom. She said sometimes you just gotta hold on and know we'll get through this.
Mom, we are so high up. Hold my hand.
No, you hold my hand.
Here we go.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more.
I learned patience from my adoptive dad. All he had to say was,
"Hey, you got this. Just breathe." Hey, we're pretty good.
Yeah.
Might have to start a band.
I got it.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org to find out more. This message is brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC. And today, I'm interviewing Antonio Gisbert, the author of Ballot Measure 118. Hi, Antonio. How are you today?
Hello, JC. I'm doing fantastically well.
Excellent. So glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So a lot of our listeners are hearing different information about Measure 118. And I was wondering if you could help clear up some of the disinformation that may be floating around.
I am happy to try. Thank you.
It would implement a massive sales tax. Can you explain your position on that?
I'll be happy to. So opponents are saying that Measure 118 is a massive tax on sales. But the reality is that Measure 118 just moves towards achieving some level of tax fairness between giant corporations, small local businesses, and Oregon personal tax payers. Right now, giant corporations like Comcast and Nike pay less than 1% in taxes to the state, while small local businesses and you and I pay between 5 and 10% taxes. That is wrong, unfair, and having giant corporations pay 3% after $25 million of in-state revenue does not seem like a bridge too far for most people. It is not a massive tax on sales. But mathematically, because when you are used to paying and the exact number is less than 0.12%, so when you're used to paying virtually zero, 3% might feel like a big number, but remember that 3% is less than what you and I pay. Corporations have been getting away paying almost nothing all along. It is time now for them to start paying some of their fair share.
So the measure is just targeting mega corporations, not citizens.
That's exactly right. The measure increases the minimum corporate tax rate for a corporation after $25 million of in-state revenue. That is not a small local business. Remember, $25 million a year is over $68,000 every single day of the year. If you have ever worked retail, you know that $68,000 is not a small business.
Here's another argument against 118, that it would make local Oregon businesses less competitive. Do you know what they mean by that?
I do not know what they mean by that, because okay. It is in fact the exact opposite. Here's what is happening today. Today, a giant, for example, Starbucks, a giant global coffee company, does business in Oregon, pays almost no taxes in Oregon, and whenever we shop at Starbucks, our money leaves the state and goes on holiday in a tax shelter in an exotic island somewhere. What Measure 118 is going to do is that it will return 3% of that money that's going on holiday to a tax shelter back to us, back to our pockets, and back to our state, so that we can spend it again. And by the way, this time, let's spend it in a local coffee shop, not a giant global brand chain.
What I'm interpreting what you're saying, Antonio, is that if people have that money rebated to them, they can actually spend money locally and support smaller businesses?
That's exactly right, JC. Or Measure 118, everyday Oregonians with a bit more cash. About $1,600 per person per year, including kids. The measure does not tell people how to spend that money. We trust people to spend the money the best way they see fit. Out of all the ways to spend that money, I personally feel that an excellent way is to spend that money locally at a local store. Shop local. Let's revive our main streets. Let's build our economy for not just our individual prosperity, but the prosperity of all Oregonians.
You're saying that it's okay to go to those large mega corporations, for example, like Comcast or Nike or Starbucks, but if they had more money, they could spend it also at smaller businesses?
Absolutely true. That's exactly it. Measure 118 is agnostic on what people will do with their rebates. It is just cash for Oregonians. We trust Oregonians to draft the text of the initiative. We trust Oregonians to collect the signatures to qualify. We trust 170,000 Oregonians who have signed the petition to qualify. And of course, we trust Oregonians to vote yes. And last but not least, we trust Oregonians to spend their rebates however most benefits them and their families.
Here's another question that I have. Proponents are saying that it would actually mean higher consumer prices, because their justification is that if Starbucks, for example, has to pay a higher tax, then they're just going to raise their prices and Oregonians are going to have to spend more money on the same products that they do now.
Yes, I have heard this as well. And I think that this is an argument about corporate greed. For example, a few years back, when we increased the minimum wage in the state of Oregon, corporations and almost all of the people who are opposing Measure 118 came out against it, arguing exactly the same thing, that they were going to retaliate against us and raise prices. What we saw is that that did not come to pass. What we have seen is that recently corporations have been gouging us from groceries, from grocery prices all the way up, to try to make us pay as much as possible for the things that we need. A couple of weeks ago, Kroger, the parent company of Fred Meyers, admitted in federal court that they had in fact increased the prices of basic groceries like milk above inflation just to make more money. Oregonians should stand up to this bullying behavior. We know that what drives price increases, or what drives the majority of price increases, is just simple corporate greed. Let's get our rebates, and with those rebates, let's shop local at small businesses that do not make more than $25 million a year, that will therefore not have a reason to increase their prices. And let's stand up to these corporate mega bullies, because enough is enough.
So, Antonio, I think our listeners might want you to answer one more question, if you could, today. And that is the argument that Measure 118 is a blank slate check for Salem politicians. What does that mean?
Thank you, JC. That is also a mystery to me, because the full text of Measure 118 is very clear that all the new revenue is accounted for. And it's accounted for in one of two buckets. First and foremost, all the new money that comes in first pays for the administration of the program. This is very important because we want Measure 118 to be revenue neutral to the state of Oregon. So money comes in, the program pays for itself, and then the money that is left over, and only that money, goes back out to the people of Oregon in the form of yearly rebates. And the estimate is that the value of those rebates will be about $1,600 per person per year. Measure 118 is absolutely not a blank check for any politicians. The money is clearly accounted for in the text of the petition.
How can they get more information about
voters? I would like to encourage everyone to go to yesonmeasure118.com, yesonmeasure118.com, and read about the facts of Measure 118. And please, one thing that's important to keep in mind is that we are people powered. The opposition is powered with $9.3 million to date. And please, let's all be mindful as you encounter that barrage of negative messaging. Let's be critical about what they are saying, because the facts are at yesonmeasure118.com.
Antonio, thank you so much for giving our listeners up-to-date information on Measure 118.
Thank you, JC, and thank you all.
KORC was able to line up an interview with representatives from the No on Measure 118 campaign. The following is an interview recorded on Monday, October 7th, with KORC's JC, and Angela Wilhelms, who is the president and CEO of Oregon Business and Industry, also known as OBI. Oregon Business and Industry is online at OregonBusinessIndustry.com and is among the top funders of the No on 118 campaign.
So, Angela, on one of the points, it says Measure 118 would implement a massive tax on sales. Could you explain your stance on that and what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not a stance. It's actually the language of the measure is a tax on sales. It's not a tax on profit or income. So the tax proposed in Measure 118 is indifferent to whether a company makes a large profit, makes a small profit, or even loses money. It's a tax on their gross sales. And we refer to it as it is a tax on sales, but also a tax on sales is actually a little more costly and expensive, or a lot more costly and expensive in some cases, to consumers than a traditional sales tax, which happens once at the end of the supply chain. This can happen at multiple stages of the supply chain. So it's that's the tax on sales piece, and the massive nature of this, it raises about $7 billion a year. That's an estimate from the Nonpartisan Legislative Revenue Office. And just for context, $7 billion, or $6.8 billion to be specific, is about 43% of our state's current general fund. This is an extraordinary amount of money. And because it's a tax on sales, it's widely accepted in economics that a gross receipts tax like this, a tax on sales, cost is passed down to consumers, whether those are individuals, households, smaller businesses, you know, local governments, you name it.
Okay. So in the measure that I saw, I thought it was a tax, if you want to call it a tax, if that's what we're going to call it, on mega corporations and those that make $25 million in in-state revenue rather than smaller businesses or individuals. Could you clarify that?
I can clarify it. So the threshold, it is a tax. I mean, that's what, it's not what we're calling it. It is a tax. That's what it calls itself in the measure. Of 3% on the gross sales, and it does apply, it kicks in at $25 million or more in sales in Oregon. But those are not mega corporations. I was in a manufacturing facility this morning as part of our annual bus tour that has more than $25 million in sales. It employs a couple hundred people in Columbia County, Oregon. It's not what anyone would describe as a mega corp, but a lot of companies exist on very small margins also. So you can have $25 million in or more in sales and have a very small profit margin and be a small or mid-sized business for sure. So there are over 2,400 companies in Oregon where this would apply directly. But the other thing to remember is when you tax those companies directly, again, they're gonna pass those costs on. So there are very significant costs and indirect impacts on people, on small businesses, et cetera. So the idea that this just affects, you know, a handful of quote unquote mega corporations, as you described them, is a complete, it's just very misleading.
Okay. Let me ask you, let's go to the next item, because I think that relates. Also, I mean, these all are related. It's very difficult to separate them in some ways, especially along with where the OBI stands on this. So Measure 118 would make local Oregon businesses less competitive. Could you talk more about that?
Absolutely. So because this is a tax on a company's gross sales, not a value-added tax or not an endpoint sales tax, it can apply at multiple stages of the supply chain. So let's take a 2x4, for example, and we actually have a fact sheet on our website that illustrates this. We know that there are companies directly affected by the tax at every stage of the supply chain of a 2x4 from root to retail. So that lumber, the timber could be harvested by an Oregon landowner. It could be milled at an Oregon mill and then sold from the mill to a wholesaler or distributor and then to a retailer. And so that's multiple times that a simple product like a 2x4, its sale would be taxed by this measure at each of those stages. And then the end consumer, you know, would have this much more expensive piece of wood. Now, that creates an incentive, and you could apply that to frozen potatoes. You could apply that to fruit filling for your pies. I mean, there's a lot of products we make in Oregon and that are made by companies and distributed by companies affected by this directly. That creates this perverse incentive to move those earlier stages of a supply chain outside of Oregon, where those companies aren't affected by this gross receipts tax or this sales tax.
So Measure 118 would mean higher consumer prices at the worst possible time. So I would like to interject or supplement that statement with a question.
Sure.
So you believe, historically, OBI has been opposed to increasing wages for, let's say, food service workers. So let's say a food service worker at McDonald's was earning, you know, just basically not a living wage. And by earning a living wage and increasing the minimum wage, we know that greed does exist and will increase prices for someone's Big Mac meal. But what is the no on 118 or the OBI's perspective on consumer pricing and why this would be anti-consumer?
Yeah, well, I think, again, when you have a tax on sales, not especially,
right.
especially when, you know, it's not a tax on profit or income, a company is going to pass those price, that the cost of that tax through to consumers. And again, consumers are individuals, households. There are also other businesses and even local governments. And so what you're going to see are higher prices resulting from that tax, which is a new cost of doing business in the state of Oregon. And a lot of these companies, take a grocery store, for example. Grocery stores typically operate on 1-3% margins, but usually no higher than that. So when you've got a tax that essentially eradicates the entire profit margin, a company only has a few options. They have to pass the cost along, or they have to cut costs. For smaller companies or more independent companies, sometimes the option is to sell or close, or it's some combination of those types of things. But I think the notion that you will have a tax on sales, and keep in mind, this tax has no exemptions for any specific types of products. So food, again, we just talked about grocery stores having those margins.
Mm-hmm.
Medicine, you know, so we're taxed, when somebody gets sick, we're gonna tax the sale of the medicine. I think that all gets passed down to the consumer. Right now in Oregon, it costs $11,000 more a year to buy the same things, to buy the same goods and services as you purchased as a household in 2021. That was a report provided to the White House. And it just belies common sense that we'd have this tax on sales, $7 billion in new revenue, and it wouldn't get passed down to consumers.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. We are speaking with Angela Wilhelms, who is the president and CEO of Oregon Business and Industry, also known as OBI.
back to that living wage for that food service worker. What is OBI's stance on that, on a living wage, and then the cost being increased to the consumer?
Well, I think we're mixing issues here. I mean, the idea that you have a measure that the nonpartisan legislative revenue office has said, Measure 118 is going to reduce growth in wages. It's said that it's going to reduce growth in income. It's going to reduce growth in jobs, period. Those are things that are not going to help lift people out of prosperity. So we believe, and our mission at OBI is to create a healthy, prosperous, and competitive economy, because it's that competitive, prosperous economy that sort of lifts everybody up together, where there's jobs for people who want them, where wages are collectively rising. So this flies in the face of that. And the opposition, the coalition that I chair, is not just about OBI. That's who I represent. You know, I can speak for OBI, but in this context, I also encourage people to look at the coalition. You know, labor organizations have opposed this, trade unions and public employee organizations. Many organizations that...
Okay. So I'm going to interrupt you for a moment, and not to be argumentative.
No, okay.
Just to present the fact that it's actually pretty evenly split across unions, labor organizations, etc., about this measure.
I would beg to differ. If you look at I think the proponent's website lists 8 total endorsements. Okay. If you look at the coalition on our website, you'll see, I don't even know the number, it's so many, but you'll see well over 8 just labor unions and organizations, you know, the United Food and Commercial Workers. There's also a group of labor unions on a website called OregoniansOppose118.com. They've taken an official position against this. So you've got the SEIU, AFSCME, the Northwest Labor Council, the teachers, the Oregon Education Association. So I would push very hard back on the idea that it's
okay.
The firefighters, yeah, you're scrolling through some of them now.
I am, yes. Okay. Thank you for that information. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah,
okay.
And on our website, if you click the coalition tab, you can see a number of other organizations. Some unions are on there also, some are on here. But you see right there the Oregon Center for Public Policy and Taxpayers, both left-leaning organizations. Then you've got the Taxpayer Association and some right-leaning organizations.
Okay. A blank check for Salem politicians. Could you explain that stance, please?
Absolutely. So Measure 118 is a statutory ballot measure. It's not a constitutional amendment like some ballot measures are. It's a statutory measure, and the legislature has purview to amend statutes at any time it sees fit in any way it desires. So the measure, according again to that nonpartisan legislative revenue office, and this is a widely accepted fact, the measure is going to result in a decrease in the funds that go into the state's general fund, which pays for education, public safety, et cetera. So the legislators, they have an incentive to, but even without that, they have the ability to amend this measure to keep the distribution, to keep the money raised and not send it out to people. So they could easily amend the statute with a simple majority vote and repurpose the money, maybe to fill that gap, maybe to fill, there's been news lately about current service levels not meeting budget revenue. So, you know, Salem politicians could easily modify this and take all or some of the distribution. So it is not a promise. The idea that this is some sort of guaranteed payment to people is a very misleading fact. It fluctuates based on amount raised, and the legislature could take all or some.
Interesting. I didn't even realize that was an issue.
Just one, 31 and 16 would be the vote count they need in the House and Senate, respectively.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So let me ask you another question. This is fascinating. When I lived in Alaska, I received the permanent fund dividend, and that was based on oil revenues. So it was a whole different thing.
Right.
Whole different thing. However, I remember that as a single mother of two children, I was able to purchase things that my children needed that I otherwise couldn't afford because of that amount of money that I received every year. Does OBI and do you as a representative of OBI recognize how this could help people who are in poverty?
You know, I think the comparison to the Alaska Permanent Fund is also misleading, because what you described is something that was decades old and was based on, as you said, sort of the extraction and sale, the generation of wealth from a resource the state had, and it was able to share in effectively the profits of that resource with its people. Right. This is very different. We're not, this $7 billion isn't coming out of nowhere. It's coming actually from the existing economy. It's not a new asset or resource like in Alaska. So many people who receive this, well, first of all, almost everyone who receives it is gonna have to pay federal tax on this. So a decent chunk of any money received is going to be taxable for federal income tax purposes. So a big chunk of it just goes to Washington, D.C. After that, the people you're talking about are going to have to contend with higher prices. So the food, medicine, and insurance, renter's insurance or car insurance, gasoline, et cetera, you know, things they need to get to work or, you know, diapers for their kid. None of that is exempted in this proposal. And that's why economists widely consider a gross receipts tax, which is what this is, to be regressive. Meaning that it will hurt those who can least afford it, people on fixed incomes, lower incomes. There are a whole bunch of people in Oregon who unfortunately live in poverty. And if we take the number of people who live in poverty and multiply it by the estimated distribution, that gets us to about $800 million in expense. This is a $6.8 billion tax. So where is that other $6 billion going? It's not means tested. It goes to higher prices. It goes to administrative costs. And we have a hard time seeing how this is a solution to lift people out of poverty. I think that's why so many organizations who provide social services, social welfare organizations, I'm thinking about like ecumenical ministries and organizations like that, why they also oppose this measure.
My understanding in my little tiny mind about economy is that Oregon is one of the lowest taxed places for businesses, especially the larger businesses like Comcast, Amazon, et cetera, Nike, on and on we go. And that businesses like, especially those big businesses like Oregon, because we have such a low taxation. Is that true? And could you speak on that a little bit?
I can't. It is not true, and I can speak to it. So,
okay.
Widely reported research on state taxation shows that Oregon's corporate tax ranking is the second worst or highest. I mean, it depends on your perspective, I guess.
Worst. Okay.
Highest, but the second most onerous, let's put it that way, in the country. If you take overall business taxation, we're near the middle, but slightly on the worse or more onerous side of the middle. I can't remember the number. Maybe Eric can chime in. I think it's 28th out of 50, again, with more onerous being the higher number. If we were such a wonderful place or some sort of tax haven, you'd see companies flocking to Oregon, and we don't have that. We rank near the bottom in job creation in the U.S. We are slipping in our ranking of best places to do business, according to CNBC, which is a widely followed ranking in the economics and business community. You know, we're trending in the wrong direction. We are actually known for being one of the higher taxed states. Business taxes in Oregon on a statewide basis have gone up 43% since 2019. And that's, so the other thing, the thing I think people often do with a measure like this is, again, they confuse a tax on sales, a tax on gross sales, gross revenue, with a tax on income or profits. And they are two very, very different things. The corporate minimum, which this amends, is not an income tax. There is an income tax. That's not what this is. So to compare what that is and what this would make it is just actually an accurate comparison. You know, there are so many flaws with this measure, to be honest, JC. Sometimes a train wreck is so bad you can't fix it. You got to just clear the tracks and start over. And that's, I think, where we're at. And that's why our coalition, which grows every day, I can't even keep up with the number, is so diverse. There's just too many flaws in this to fix.
Angela, I want to thank you so much for meeting with me. I know this is a contentious issue.
Well, thank you for your interest and time. I mean, it's community. It's community news and community groups like yours helping to get the word out that really matters. So I appreciate the interest and happy to do it.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Kroll. Indigenous Peoples Day is a holiday in the United States that celebrates and honors Indigenous American peoples and commemorates their histories and cultures. It is celebrated across the United States on the second Monday in October. This year, that would be October 14th. If you're listening to the Sunday edition, that would be tomorrow. Or perhaps you're tuned in between 5 and 6 on Monday, in which case today is Indigenous Peoples Day. It began as a counter-celebration held on the same day as the U.S. federal holiday of Columbus Day, which honors Italian explorer and infamous colonizer Christopher Columbus. Some people do not observe Columbus Day at all, citing the lasting harm indigenous tribes suffered because of Columbus's contributions to the European colonization of the Americas. Indigenous Peoples Day was instituted in Berkeley, California in 1992 to coincide with the 500th anniversary of the arrival of Columbus in the Americas on October 12, 1492. 2 years later, Santa Cruz, California instituted the holiday, and starting in 2014, many other cities and states adopted the holiday. In 2021, President Joe Biden formally commemorated the holiday with a presidential proclamation, becoming the first U.S. president to do so. And presidential proclamations have also been issued in 2022 and 2023. Indigenous Peoples Day is not currently a recognized federal holiday under U.S. federal law. If you are tuned in on Monday, October 14th, we at KORC wish you a happy Indigenous Peoples Day.
Hi, neighbors. This is Claire Gilgannon, here to talk with you about turkey vultures. Yes, folks, you heard me correctly. I said turkey vultures. Those wonderful darlings of decay we often see soaring on thermals above our neighborhoods or in the wide open spaces of agricultural grasslands and riparian zones. Did you know that turkey vultures consume, nearly exclusively, the dead and decaying flesh of animals killed by disease, roadside collision, or natural causes? Yes, absolutely metal as fuck, I know. They lack the strength in their talons to grasp and kill live prey, so instead use their keen sense of sight and smell to locate their dead meals. By consuming decaying flesh, turkey vultures provide a key ecosystem service to all of us. Not only do they remove what would otherwise be left to rot, turkey vultures are also immune to many communicable diseases, including the rabies virus, which can infect pets, livestock, and humans, and is always fatal if left untreated. Turkey vultures don't give a f***. They digest it and then even regurgitate it for their babies. And a turkey vulture that consumes infected meat effectively removes it from the environment, thereby reducing the presence of diseases that could otherwise harm us. So give them a break. Take a moment to appreciate the next turkey vulture you spot. And if you see a turkey vulture feasting on a carcass alongside a road or highway, give them space. Change lanes if it's safe to do so, or slow down to reduce the chance the birds will attempt to take flight. Collision with vehicles injures and kills thousands of turkey vultures each year, and we need them around. Understand and respect their place in the ecosystem. You are listening to KORC.